Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that Angela Walker and I ran on. So I first want to talk about the climate. It's been a bad week for the climate, a bad couple of weeks. We've had 2 weeks of record-breaking heat in the Northern Hemisphere across U.S., Europe, in China. In fact, it's the hottest weather the world has seen since the last ice age ended about 10,000 years ago. And it's not just land heat or the air heat, it's the ocean heat. The oceans are running a fever as well. They're the warmest we have on record globally. And the oceans are a big deal because they absorb 90% of the heat that is created by greenhouse gas emissions. And now off the coast of Florida, they're 7 degrees higher than normal, 94 degrees in the water off Florida. And this hot water is decimating coral reefs around Florida and throughout the Caribbean. And 25% of all marine life depends on coral reefs, the ecosystem that they create, including dolphins and turtles and sharks. And the waters are also 7 degrees warmer in the North Atlantic, west of Ireland and the British Isles, which is affecting the weather there. They're going to get more extreme storms. They've had some. And it's also creating conditions, the heat in both places to the meteorologists are predicting more hurricanes this season. They've just upped their prediction from 12 to 18 hurricanes coming toward the Americas from the South Atlantic. And part of the sea wave is explained by the formation of El Nino that is taking hold off the coast of Peru and Chile and the Eastern Pacific. But this year's El Nino has started months earlier than previous El Ninos, and they last for 1 to 3 years. So, and this is one of the factors causing this heat wave in the Northern Hemisphere. So we're in the midst of a deadly heat wave. And our political leaders in the U.S. and around the world this week made stupid decisions. Last week, I talked about how we had a little victory in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia that blocked construction to complete the Mountain Valley Pipeline for frack gas that would go from Appalachia up in Western Virginia with fracked oil or gas from Ohio and Pennsylvania, as well as West Virginia, down to Virginia and then all the way to North Carolina. And already the companies building have appealed to the Supreme Court. And already their amicus briefs backing the pipeline that have been filed by, you guessed it, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia that wants that pipeline, a bunch of Republican House members. And unfortunately, no surprise here, the Biden administration. So they want to build this frack gas pipeline at all costs as we're in the midst of this heat wave. Meanwhile, Biden's climate envoy, John Kerry, was in China to meet with his counterparts in the Chinese leadership. And this is why these heat waves are going on. And unfortunately, nothing much came of the discussions. One thing Kerry said that's not good is he said the U.S. will never pay reparations to the global South for the damage and loss it has caused to those countries by climate change that the U.S. is responsible for. And China's also said it has no obligation to pay reparations, even though now it's the country with the world's largest emissions. They say they're recovering from Western colonialism, even though now they have the world's largest economy. But they're not taking any responsibility. Together with the U.S.'s 14% of global emissions, U.S. and China account for 44% of global emissions. And they could partner to lead a world transition to clean energy. Now, Kerry had hoped to talk to China about getting on a faster timeline for emissions reductions, but China flatly rejected that. In particular, Kerry was trying to persuade China to stop building coal plants and curtail methane emissions from its fossil gas and coal infrastructure. But China rejected that as well. And, you know, it's important to realize how much China is contributing and actually expanding its emissions. It now burns more coal than the rest of the world combined. It has the world's largest coal reserves, which they apparently intend to use. And they're expanding coal mining and building, at this point, 300 more coal-fired plants, while the U.S. is phasing them out and Europe is phasing them out. And the coal plants are being built by state-owned enterprises because private companies don't want to build them because they don't think they'll be profitable in the long run as the world goes to renewables. And renewables are cheaper than coal. China's building many of these coal plants in the west of China, where most of the utility scale solar and wind installations they're building. And the idea is to provide baseload power. But baseload power can be provided in the arid west of China by various means, like of energy storage, like compressed air energy storage, the batteries that are ever improving, and geothermal energy, which recycles the water between the ground and the power plant. And that is their new technologies enable us to go deeper where it's hotter. And that technology is advancing very fast. So there are other ways of providing base load. And these underground mines that China is digging produce massive amounts of methane, which has a climate warming potential 85 times greater than carbon dioxide over the first 20 years and 33 times greater over the first 100 years. And the reason for the difference is methane breaks up at a faster pace than carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide, its half-life is many times longer than carbon dioxide. That's why the impact of methane is so important. And it's important because, you know, the next 20 years is when we've got to make this transition. Or, you know, we're not going to have a climate that is livable. And Kerry said that climate cooperation should be on a separate track from other issues between China and the U.S. because the climate emergency is too important. He's right about that. But the Chinese said, no, we got to link this to climate to other issues like Taiwan, which means there's not going to be much cooperation if they try to link everything. And while Kerry was there, Chinese President Xi Jinping, who did not meet with Kerry, made a separate speech in which he said China will not agree to international carbon reduction programs, that China is going to make its transition at its own pace and in its own way. And their goal for zero emissions is 2060, which is way too late to stop a climate catastrophe. And, you know, the irony here is that China is building more renewable energy capacity than the rest of the world combined. And they're also aggressively acquiring dominant positions in renewable energy supply chains for rare earth minerals that are needed for renewable energy technologies, as well as the key renewable energy components, you know, like they're the biggest producer of solar panels, which for us should mean that's an argument for socialism, that, you know, nobody should be monopolizing these resources because the earth's minerals and the technology we developed are the commonwealth of all of us. They're the legacy of nature or, you know, previous human endeavors. And they should be distributed around the world according to need, not profits. And, you know, of course, China calls itself socialist, but it acts in the world economy according to capitalist precepts. Which brings me to the question of what is the nature of global capitalism and imperialism today? I mean, we're having a lot of debate about the emergence of a multipolar world. And some people say it's really kind of thinking bipolar world. They're saying it's the West versus the rest. And if the rest, you know, gain power in the world economy, it's going to open the door to socialist development. And I think that's wrong because, you know, these emerging powers are capitalist through and through. I think what we need to do is understand, yes, the world's becoming multipolar, but it's also multilateral. there is as much multilateral cooperation as there is multipolar competition between the big imperialist powers, the sub-imperialist powers, and the exploited nations of the global south. So, in other words, the imperialist and sub-imperialist countries both cooperate and compete. And the bigger imperialist powers share management of global capitalism through multilateral institutions like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and what's often overlooked, but is unfortunately true, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which organizes these conferences of the parties, the so-called COP climate conferences. And there was a Brazilian Marxist and dependency theorist named Rui Mauro Marini, who developed a theory about dependency and then imperialism and sub-imperialism. And he said, you know, these powers have antagonistic cooperation. In other words, they're competing at the same time they're cooperating in some spheres. You know, another way, you could just call them frenemies. There's a political economist in South Africa named Patrick Bond who uses this framework of antagonistic cooperation to analyze how his home country of South Africa and the BRICS countries, you know, those are the emerging powers, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China. What's the S stand for? I'm forgetting right now. But anyway, these emerging powers, they have an organization, but they plug into the hierarchy of imperialist and sub-imperialist nations, and they compete with each other as well as cooperate in the global multilateral management of global capitalism. And I think that's an important framework to think about because the people that praise the emergence of a multipolar world as if it's gonna open up space for socialist development, you know, they kind of pose the world as the West versus the rest. And it's also true that the rest is cooperating with the West in the management of this exploitive capitalist system, including imperialism. And, you know, just to take China in particular, they play a large role in the IMF, where they have the third largest number of votes, in supporting the neoliberal austerity, deregulation, and privatization conditions that are put on loans to countries. And also in the COP conferences, they partnered particularly with the U.S. in policies that would privatize the atmosphere with carbon markets and offsets. So you see what I'm saying? There's competition, but there's also cooperation. And, you know, alongside what we hear, the nationalist and militarist rhetoric coming from these different countries, and sometimes they're engaged in armed conflict by proxy, they mostly cooperate from what I can see. Let me give some examples. When the Russian troops went into Kazakhstan last year to suppress the popular uprising of oil workers, what were they protecting? The property of US-based oil majors like Chevron, Exxon, and ConocoPhillips. Another example, the Israeli Air Force has been bombing Iranian military targets in Syria for years, and with increasing frequency, at least weekly this year. But they can't do that without the cooperation of Russia and the United States, because Russia controls the Western Syrian airspace, the US controls Eastern Syrian airspace, and Israeli bombers can't go in there without getting permission from the Russians and the US. So there the US and Russia are cooperating with Israel against Iran. And Iran and Russia are together with Assad against the opposition. So it gets complicated. They compete and they cooperate. I think a major reason for Israel's refusal to send arms to Ukraine, yet voted to condemn the Russian invasion of Ukraine in the United Nations, is that they're trying to stay on the good side of both Russia and the United States so they can continue those bombing runs into Syria against Iranian targets. Another example, when U.S. factories move to China, they take advantage of repressive labor conditions and lax environmental enforcement. And that's to the mutual benefit both of the U.S. investors and their Chinese counterparts. A lot of times these are joint ventures. Even when they're not, their taxes to be paid to the Chinese government. So they're cooperating there in the exploitation of the Chinese working class. And then, you know, I could go on and on with examples, but I think the most ominous, given that we're talking about climate and just what's going on in the world, the most ominous of the cooperation are the horrific consequences for our survival of imperialist powers cooperating in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the COP climate conferences. And Patrick Bond, who I suggest you Google him and read some of the things he's been writing about this. He's characterized the COP climate conferences as, quote, the most decisive multilateral site for China, Russia, other BRICS, and similar fossil-dependent sub-imperial powers to agree to Western demands that there be no binding processes on greenhouse gas emission reductions, no reparations for climate-related loss and damage, no counting of military-related emissions, no insistence that fossil fuel firms leave unburnable carbon in the ground as stranded assets. They've supported carbon markets and offsets that's privatizing the world's atmosphere. And they are fully supporting the intellectual property rights that are limiting the spread of solar, wind, and other renewable energy technologies, even to those importers that are willing to pay the market price. So there we have it. You know, the US, China, the BRICS are cooperating in a deadly climate policy. And I'm going to put in the chat, or Chris is going to put in the chat, I think an important article about inter-imperialist cooperation with fossil capital. It was written by a group of socialists from Ukraine, Russia, Poland, and Germany. And it's called Support Ukrainian Resistance and Disempower Fossil Capital. And what these socialists warn, and this came out last August, is that there are many powerful capitalist interests in the West, particularly the fossil fuel interests, that don't really support Ukraine's struggle for independence. Western imperialists were forced into what support they provided to Ukraine by the popular and armed resistance that the Ukrainian people mounted, particularly at the beginning when they threw back the Russian assault on the capital of Kyiv. And then their own domestic constituencies demanded some support for Ukraine. So remember, at the time, they were telling, you know, Zelensky and the government to get out of Dodge. We'll set you up as a government in exile in Poland or somewhere. And the Ukrainian government refused, which kind of puts to rest the idea that they're just a puppet of the U.S. And these authors of that article that I put in the chat warn that Western imperialist elites, from the oil and gas barons to people like Henry Kissinger and even the NATO General Secretary Jens Stoltenberg, are pushing Ukraine to cut a land for peace deal, because what they really want is they want to go back to business as usual. The Russian market is larger than the Ukrainian market, but they also want to be able to exploit the labor and fossil and mineral resources and agricultural resources of a weaker, what would be a weaker Ukrainian state. So I urge you to read that, because I think it really gives a picture that it's not as simple as, you know, U.S. Versus Russia and the Ukrainians don't count. It's not a bipolar, multipolar world of the West versus the rest. It's a world of global capitalism and imperialism where the various imperialist powers both cooperate and also compete in different spheres. So what does that mean for us? I think what we need to be doing is developing campaigns of practical solidarity with democratic, progressive, and socialist movements in all countries. And I think two good examples I think I'll leave you with. One is the campaign to cancel Ukraine's foreign debt. The left in Ukraine has been asking for that. There's been very little done in the U.S. The Green member of parliament in the U.K., Caroline Lucas, has done a lot and made some progress in getting at least debt relief, if not cancellation, from the U.K. But you know, the U.S. is a big, the biggest block of votes in the International Monetary Fund, which holds a lot of this foreign debt. A lot of foreign debt is held by Western banks, particularly U.S.-based banks. So that gives us organizing targets to campaign for the cancellation of debt. And the other thing, and we'll put a couple of links in the chat on this, I think I talked about it last week, is we've got a campaign to get the UN General Assembly to vote to send a peacekeeping force to the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which is in a real state of crisis. And it would, you know, go in there and secure it and demilitarize the plant. And the politics are, if the United Nations General Assembly voted even in stronger numbers than they did to condemn Russia's invasion, and the theory is that the 35 countries who abstained, would be willing to vote for this because it's not directly crossing Russia, with whom they have various military and economic relationships. It's just saying we need to, you know, protect the plant for the sake of the whole world. And then if that happened, you know, Russia might feel compelled to say, okay, we'll let the UN peacekeeping force take our place because they're now militarily occupying that Zaporizhzhia power plant. And, you know, what this campaign does is give us organizing targets across the geopolitical divides, including the U.S. We can go to our members of Congress, demand action, and we can also demand that Russia accept the UN Assembly resolution if it passed. So I think that's the kind of thing we got to do if we're going to have a anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist movement. We got to be with the popular movements for democracy, justice, socialism, and not siding with states who are in competition with each other, capitalist states. So I'll leave it there. And I'm looking forward to your questions and comments. Michael Lavery, hey, Howie. Thanks for talking about this important issue. This affects all of us the same. We are getting massive flooding in the Northeast. Yeah, I used to live in Vermont, and I've seen places I've been be, you know, totally flooded. You know, 8 inches of rain in one day, I believe. and this is becoming the new normal. They call it a 100-year flood, but they've had two of them in Vermont in the last 10 years. And that's because with global heating, there's more moisture in the atmosphere, and then it comes down. So this is, the presidential campaign last time had very little discussion of this. You know, we had our eco-socialist Green New Deal. Joe Biden said he was not for a Green New Deal. He had his own climate policy. We see what that was. It's, the Inflation Reduction Act, which I call Build Back Badly, because it, opens the door for more permitting of fossil fuel drilling on public lands. And, they're supporting this Mountain Valley Pipeline. It's not enough money into renewables. It's through the private sector, so it's incentives rather than mandates, which means it's going to depend on the corporations that got us in this mess to get us out of it with these incentives. And I could go on and on about that. So I hope in this campaign, you know, Cornel West, likely the Green candidate. I know it's not his wheelhouse, but I hope he will get up to speed. I have talked to him a little bit about it, and I know he wants to. I know he gave a speech this week or was in a discussion. Maybe it was online with a college campus in Arizona where climate was an issue. And, you know, I saw he was, you know, good on the moral and environmental danger of climate change, but not very concrete in terms of what we got to do. You know, and I think one of the things, and this is now in the Green platform, to distinguish us from what the Democrats are doing. They're trying to do this through the private sector with incentives, corporate welfare, and consumer rebates that only, you know, middle and upper middle consumers can, afford to make the purchase and then get the rebate. So it's very class biased and it's hit or miss, like I said. And what we need is like what we had during World War II when the federal government took over a quarter of the manufacturing capacity of this country, to build what Franklin Roosevelt, the president, called the arsenal of democracy, to arm the Allies against the Nazis and the fascists in Italy and Tojo in Japan. And, you know, we provided massive amounts of arms to the British and the French and the Soviets, and as well as we sent special forces fighting with Ho Chi Minh and Mao Zedong against the Chinese and Japanese imperialists. You know, it's funny how, allies shift, because then we went into the Cold War, which was unnecessary. But anyway, you know, what we need to do, like we did during World War II, to deal with that military crisis is put a lot of this through the public sector to solve this climate crisis. And I hope Cornell or whoever the Green nominee is can force that issue onto the agenda and, demand that we get real action. And otherwise, it's probably not going to be much talked about. Biden will say a little bit about what he did, and Trump will call it a hoax, and but it won't get the attention or build the urgency for climate change that people want. And I think, you know, for us, for Cornell West, if he's the candidate, there are a lot of young people mad as hell at Biden. You know, they wanted much stronger action on the climate than they got. And, you know, they might want to vote for that. And while I'm talking about the election, I think another thing that people should say when they're accused of spoiling the election is, no, the Greens improve elections. I think I talked about this last week, about our congressional district, how the only time a Democrat has won in the last 50 years is when a Green was in the race, because we made the Democrat deal with our issues. He sounded better than he did when he was just running against the Republican and trying to capture votes to his right. And I think I used the model of the Wallace campaign in 1948, where Henry Wallace had a very progressive domestic program that was popular. It was continuing to build upon what had been done in the New Deal. And Truman basically co-opted that the last two or three months of the campaign, and his popularity surged, and he caught up to Dewey. So that's how the Wallace campaign changed the whole debate. And it didn't lead to, he didn't split the vote so the right could win. He basically improved what the Democrat was doing, so at least the center won. So anyway, kind of a long answer to a short comment, but there you are. Violet at Content Boutique. Southern California is having a huge toxic bloom, killing all kinds of wildlife, dolphins, sea lions, etc. And they're telling us to ride bicycles. What the heck? No mention of oil industry responsibility. Yeah. One of the big impetuses for the environmental movement that led to Earth Day was a huge oil spill from a drilling rig off the Southern California coast near Santa Barbara. And the oil went on the beaches, and people are out there, you know, trying to help the birds get the oil off their feathers and, you know, deal with the sea lions and dolphins and others that were, you know, ended up washing up shore to try to avoid the oil. It was very impactful, and it got good media coverage. Today the oil industry, we're getting all kinds of, you know, reports in the media of how, you know, they've spent so much on lobbying and, just co-opting the whole government to respond to their wishes. I mean, you know, they're still getting subsidies to produce oil and gas. It's insane. And, the toxic blooms, a lot of that's due to the heating. It can also be due to runoff from chemical fertilizers and agriculture. But the oceans are in trouble. You know, when the reefs die, a lot of other marine wildlife dies because the ecosystem that the coral reefs set up are very bountiful. And, you know, it's where many of these organisms breed, they feed, It's just essential to the ocean ecosystems. And they're, you know, outside of Florida and in the Caribbean right now, they're bleaching out. They're dying. And we've had that problem going on the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. It's a huge problem. And, you know, we're in an emergency, and the government's acting like it's just another issue they can, you know, maybe deal with someday. Z Manny, hi. I saw a chart showing how in 2020, the total human population produced mass like concrete, plastic, etc., has now exceeded the total biomass of all life on Earth. Yeah, how do we redress this? There's a big discussion of degrowth, which we talked about in January with David Schwartzman, who's a climate scientist and activist, professor emeritus at Howard University, and has written a lot on this question. He has a critical perspective on degrowth because he says we have to degrow certain sectors of the economy while we grow other sectors like renewable energy, and need to produce enough energy so that we get to about 2.5 kilowatt hour energy per person, which would bring everybody up to the standard where maximum lifespans are, you know, happen. And everybody should deserve that. But that's, you know, much more than we use in the United States. We use about four times that much, four or five times that much kilowatt hours per person. So, you know, concrete is very energy intensive. It's very carbon intensive, although you can produce it in ways that actually sequester carbon. But, you know, that's why we need it through the public sector, because, you know, concrete factories, they're not going to scrap their old technology and build whole new technology. That wouldn't be profitable. So it's got to be done through the public sector, where we publicly subsidize at least the initial investment to create the new concrete producing technology so that it can get going. And then, you know, as it's going and it sells its product, it will, you know, pay back that initial investment. Plastics, we need to, you know, looks like we just got to stop. Even the so-called biodegradable plastics really aren't. You know, it's a huge problem now. The microplastics are in all of us. They're in our food. They're in our lungs. They're all over the world. And, you know, they are endocrine disruptors, which means it gets our hormones off. They some of them are carcinogenic. So we need to, you know, we know how to package stuff, you know, paper and glass and clay pottery and so forth. So that shouldn't be a technological problem, but it's a huge political problem. But we've really got to have a radical change in our technology. It needs to be ecologically compatible technology. And again, it's not going to happen, you know, with incentives to the private sector. It needs to be with, you know, mandates to phase certain things out. And some of these sectors need to be publicly owned and planned so we can make the transition. See, Manny, what are we supposed to do with all that mass that's sitting around? Even if we reform, it's occupying all that space and mass. Is it possible to reduce that? I know people are working on ways of, you know, like gathering all that plastic floating in the Pacific Ocean. I don't know if they figured out a way to what to do with the microplastics. One of the things, you know, to deal with that is, you know, they find bacteria that can consume just about anything. And if it's got carbon in it, like plastic did, it does. Most of it's derived from fossil fuels. We got a whole fracking to plastics pipeline that's being built in Appalachia where they're going to use frack gas to provide feedstock for the manufacturing of plastics, and factories they're building in southeastern Ohio and probably West Virginia. So, you know, that's another connection between plastics and fossil fuels that we need to break. So, you know, what you do with all that plastic, I mean, you can sequester it and isolate it. And then the concrete, that's pretty inert. I mean, it's just like, you know, sand and rock and stuff like that. So I think, you know, that can be, you know, reintegrated into Earth's crust without much problem. I think the plastics are the biggest waste problem. And, you know, that needs to be taken on directly. And again, that's an issue that, you know, there's some good groups out there like Beyond Plastics, Google them, that are doing good work on this. But it's not, certainly not been a major issue that's ever been discussed in a presidential election. You rarely hear it discussed in most congressional elections. So that's why we need the Green Party. It's up to us to bring that question forward with solutions. And, you know, some of them are still being developed, but, you know, research and development funding for those solutions is needed. Emil Sachs, Howie, any plans to get local Greens on the show? Or even indies, independents like Mejia or McLaughlin, who used to be Greens? I had a, what's the name, first name, Mejia, the guy who's now comptroller of Los Angeles. I have had him on the show. Gail McLaughlin from Richmond. I think that's a good idea. And, you know, I know how to get a hold of her. I think that's a great idea. And it would be good to hear about what they're doing these days. Yeah, certainly Gail McLaughlin. I'm not sure about Mejia. He's a Democrat, and he's not independent. He's a Democrat. And he's had some controversies now that he's comptroller of Los Angeles. So, you know, I guess I have a question of whether he'd be appropriate to bring back. But, you know, Gail, I think, would be a very interesting guest. I think people would be interested. So I will pursue that. I'll announce this at the end, but I'll say it right now. I've got two guests lined up. Let's see. August 5th, I will have Rafael Bernabe, who is a senator in the Puerto Rican Senate, elected from the Citizens Victory Movement, a left-wing third party. And he's going to talk about the parallels between Russia attempting to colonize Ukraine and U.S. colonization of Puerto Rico, and why both countries need a Green New Deal to reconstruct. So Rafael is he's a radical socialist. He'll be an interesting guest. That's August 5th. And then August 12th, we'll have Svetlana Romanko, who is from Ukraine. She was the Ukraine representative for 350.org. She's a climate activist. You may remember she is the woman that confronted the Russian delegation at the last COP conference for being an imperialist petrostate, attacking her country and destroying the world environment. She got thrown out, but she got her point across. And now she runs a group called Razum We Stand. Razum means together in Ukrainian. And so she's going to talk about, stopping the petrostates and how we can support a green reconstruction of Ukraine. So that's on the 12th. And I've got some other guests the next 2 weeks as well, I hope. And I will confirm that with you as soon as I know. Cole McMullen, Howie, should Greens running at the state level campaign on the idea of worker governance of state-owned alcohol vendors where applicable? Yeah, some states, I know New Hampshire, at least when I was up in that area, alcohol was sold through state-owned stores. And yeah, worker governance of all enterprises, you know, workers should have a role in, electing people to the boards of these enterprises, whether they're public or private. And if they're private, you know, worker cooperatives is what we should have. So then workers get a return on their investment of labor proportional to the labor they contributed. And that's where the surplus goes, instead of going to profits to capitalists who didn't work at all. They just owned it. So that's something that we should, you know, push across the board. Wherever people work, whatever kind of enterprise, you know, it should be democratic. So, you know, people doing the work actually know better than the supervisors. I've found that throughout my life working in construction and then, you know, the UPS warehouse, unloading trucks. And, you know, it's funny. I'm just thinking of UPS, which the strike, you know, looks like it's coming. I think there's a pretty good chance they'll go on strike August 1st. You know, they get guys that come in and they start working, loading or unloading trucks in the warehouses. And then if they seem like they might be management material, they get co-opted into being supervisors. And, you know, they've hardly learned how to do the job. And suddenly they're trying to order around us who know how to do the job. And usually their advice was stupid. Same thing I found in construction sites. You know, you're working for a construction firm. The boss comes around and tells everybody how they're doing everything wrong, but what he's telling us to do is wrong. I mean, I'm sure that's, you know, true in a lot of industries. So, yeah, workers know what they're doing, and so they should definitely have a say. And also, you know, certainly in the private sector, they should be getting their full and fair share of the surplus they create as additional income to the regular wage they get. Z Manny, West's high profile is already attracting lots of attention to the Greens. Are Greens using this window of opportunity now to recruit much larger numbers to run for local and state offices? I think that's an open question. Yeah, Cornell is getting, you know, more major media attention every day than I got in my whole campaign. And, you know, a lot of it's negative, but hey, you know, you can take that because it gives you a platform to push back. And so, you know, that helps a lot. And I have heard, you know, we had Steve Welser on here from New Jersey saying, you know, New Jersey is going to try to run a congressional candidate in every all 12 congressional districts in New Jersey. I think that's great. And then there's, I think, you know, Greens need to focus more on state legislature and, you know, city and town councils. Now, some states have those elections in off years, you know, odd years instead of even years, but some don't. But, you know, as we go into 2024 and people get excited about a Green presidential campaign, it's time to start thinking about the local campaigns the next year. And I hope we can do that. I think it's an open question. I think we've had fewer candidates really since 2016. I think we were hit by the pull of Sanders toward the Democratic Party. Sanders was saying some things we were saying. The push of Trump, who is such a right-wing, authoritarian, racist reactionary that, you know, people said, oh, I got to go to the Democrats to stop this fool. And we lost people that way. And then COVID hurt. You know, we were having less local meetings, and I think there was kind of a demoralized climate, not just in the Greens, across the left, because of this Trumpist phenomenon, which I think people overestimate. That racist authoritarian current in American politics has been there since slavery through Jim Crow and beyond. And Trump kind of gave it permission to speak out more openly. I think, though, the optimistic side of that is they have declined demographically. Just look at the votes for Nixon and Wallace combined. And Nixon was using racist dog whistles throughout that 1968 campaign. Nixon and Wallace combined were close to 60%. The core of, you know, MAGA Republicans are about 30%. That's the racist authoritarian streak. And then, you know, the country club Republicans that don't want to pay taxes also voted for Trump, but they aren't so reactionary on other questions. So what I'm saying is, you know, we're gaining on the, and we're defeating that far right. And, you know, I think another thing I was reading the other day, you know, Generation Z hardly has any Trump supporters. And I think, what did I read? 20 million older folks died since 2020, and 32 million Generation Z folks came into the electorate. So the demographics are moving in a more progressive direction. So, you know, I hope we get out of these doldrums and start challenging, you know, what's happening. The climate crisis isn't going away. Inequality is not getting better. Nuclear arms race is getting worse. There's every reason for the Greens to be running at every level. And, you know, we know our local issues. You know, the cops are still killing people. They're still brutalizing people. The real estate industry is still segregating us and still gentrifying poor people out of neighborhoods in good locations. And I could go on and on. And we got local issues we got to address. You know, somebody mentioned the plastic issues. What about these forever chemicals, the PFAS family, that are in our bodies now? And production has stopped. They have begun to find ways to mitigate it. I think it involved bacteria that actually consume it, change it into something else, and that's benign. There's so much to do on the environmental front locally, you know. So if your community is affected by PFAS and the forever chemicals, there's an issue. So, yeah, I think we do have a window of opportunity, and we should jump through it and take advantage of it. Zimani, negative exposure also helped Trump win. Some kind of laws of media physics. Either way, more people are learning about the Greens. Yeah, that's what I keep telling the Greens. You know, it's better that they attack us than they ignore us. Because then they're, you know, media that is not, you know, completely, you know, biased and trying to, you know, push their point in trying to be a legitimate news organization. You know, if they write something and you can push back, they got to give you the forum. Or they should give you the forum. I mean, I said got to, and, you know, I did that in 2020. I got more coverage in Europe and Latin America than I did in America. So, but Cornell has got a higher media profile than I did. So he should be able to take advantage of that. Amy L. Sachs, related to Howie's discussion now, our local chapter has talk about pushing to lower the voting age. Too many entitled libertarian fifth columnist boomers won't hear of it, though. Oh, I think you're talking about those kind of folks in the Greens. Yeah, and I don't know how libertarian those people are if they think 16-year-olds shouldn't vote. That's been the number that people have been kicking around. They do it in some cities. I remember when I was 16, I couldn't wait to vote. And I, you know, big issues in my time were Vietnam and civil rights. And when I was 16, I could have voted for the Peace and Freedom Party ticket for president. Peace in Vietnam, freedom was the civil rights, you know, slogan. So all I could do is urge adults. At that time, the voting age was 21. I still had 5 years to wait. I mean, it was another presidential election. Fortunately, we got the age lowered to 18, a constitutional amendment. People say they can't be done, but it was done. And so I got to vote in the 1972 election. For the People's Party candidacy of Benjamin Spock, the baby doctor that, you know, guided my generation's rearing, and Julius Hobson, who had founded the DC Statehood Party, and which became, when it merged with the Green Party, the DC Statehood Green Party. So, you know, we have roots in the Green Party going back to the 60s. Rex by Yale, why shouldn't I vote for RFK Jr.? He's crazy. He's anti-Semitic. He can't stay away from right-wing conspiracy theories. He keeps spouting stuff about vaccines and autism, which the scientific community has, you know, rejected for decades. So, you know, I don't know what else to tell you. Besides, what are you voting in the Democratic Party for? You know, he's a Democrat. Violet at Content Boutique. Howie, the cobalt we use for lithium batteries is being mined by four-year-old children in Africa for $1 a day. Any suggestions for substitutions? This plan we're working is not going to work. Well, we need the lithium. And lithium, yeah, it's being mined in China, Latin America, Africa. You know, what I know more about in Africa is cobalt. And it's Chinese companies in Katanga, the province that separated with the encouragement of the U.S. and Belgium when they assassinated Lumumba, who was the legitimate leader of the Congo back in, you know, I think in 1960, still under the Eisenhower administration. And so, you know, that helped open up, you know, the Congo to exploitation. Ironically, at that time, we saw the Chinese as communist enemies, and now they're capitalist exploiters of the Congo, which we tried to open up for exploitation. So the contradictions go on. What we got to insist on is that when there's mining for these minerals, it be done in a way that's safe, protects the environment, and children aren't the ones doing it. I know there are a lot of children, like in Central African Republic, who are doing what they call artisanal mining for gold. And, you know, it's not healthy. There's lots of, you know, dust with heavy metals in it that harms, you know, their health. And, of course, they're making pennies. That's next to mines that actually the Wagner mercenary group from Russia has concessions granted to it because they are the gendarme for the leadership of the Central African Republic. And they got the same kind of deal in Mali. They also have deals for cutting the rainforest and selling the timber. So yeah, that's just the brutal bottom level of imperialism. And, you know, U.S. corporations have done it for, you know, generations, you know, whether it's copper or lithium. And so that's a matter of, you know, organizing workers, getting labor and environmental standards adopted nationally and then internationally in trade agreements. And it's a whole big fight. And, you know, substitutions for lithium, I think, you know, we've talked about this. I'm trying to remember the technology, but it has to do with, yeah, I can't remember the technology, but there were other options, including, as I recall, hemp fiber to conduct the electricity in batteries, if I remember right. But yeah, there are other technologies, but, you know, we're still going to have to, you know, bring these rare earth minerals out of the ground. It's got to be done in a safe, environmentally safe, safe for the workers. Workers should be fairly compensated. And then when the lithium enters the economy, it should be recycled to the maximum extent. So we have a recycling zero waste economy. That should be our goal. And that reduces the amount we have to extract. But there's no excuse under any circumstances for four-year-old children working for a dollar a day. That even sounds high from the kind of wages I'm hearing. So, yeah, the mining industry, you know, really should be socialized. It should be a public utility. It's drawing out the commonwealth that nature created for all of us. And it should have, you know, public standards that are good on the environment and the labor conditions. Frankie Lee, with all the money we spend on weapons contractors, any chance of getting better health care for people or housing for the homeless? You know, we're so rich as a country, and the rich have so much they could pay in taxes, that we could provide health care for all and housing for the homeless, even with the damn military budget we've got. Now, that budget should be cut. I've said 75% with the savings devoted to human and environmental needs. But, you know, if we went with single-payer health care, national health insurance, we'd save money the first year. Of course, we want to go beyond that. our policy paper from the 2020 campaign said we want to build out from national health insurance to a national health system where the hospitals and clinics and all the ancillary industries that are part of healthcare are publicly owned and democratically controlled through elected health boards at the local level, which in turn elect representatives to state and federal boards. But that would save money because, you know, now there was an article out this week somebody wrote, not the first time this point has been made, but with the amount of money we pay in taxes for Medicare, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, the VA, we could have Medicare for all and just get rid of the amount we're paying the private sector. We pay more than double any other country. And for healthcare, we both pay the taxes for those public programs and our private healthcare insurance if we got it. And that's double because there's so much wasted on just paperwork to figure out, you know, is this patient covered by who? Will they cover this service? Will they help pay for this medicine? And it's a lot of back and forth. And there have been studies that have shown that some of these insurance companies just, you know, every fifth or every third, you know, request for payment that comes in, they just say no. And then they get in a back and forth. And oftentimes, you know, the payment is should be paid under their policy, but the provider has to fight for it. That's just an enormous waste of time and resources and people power. So we could have healthcare for all, even without cutting the military budget, and housing for the homeless. You know, I forget the numbers. We did it when I was running. I think we want to spend $100 billion a year over 10 years to build out public housing to a level where everybody could afford a house. All the homeless would be housed. You know, that's about a tenth of what we're spending on the military. So, you know, we could tax the rich a little more to do that. That's not to say we shouldn't cut the military budget, but the idea that only the military budget is keeping us from healthcare for all and housing for all is not true. What's keeping us there are these capitalist politicians that are bought and paid for by the health insurance industry, in the case of healthcare and the pharmaceutical companies, and in the case of housing, the developers and the real estate interests. You know, they really don't care about low-income housing because they can't make money off it. They want to cater to the upscale, and they don't want any, competition from public housing or even subsidized affordable housing that developers build privately. So that's what's stopping us. It's a damn capitalists and the capitalist politicians they buy. Z. Manny, any updates on efforts to redress Cuomo's draconian ballot access changes? I heard Greens and Libertarians are challenging this now. Yeah, the Greens and Libertarians have a lawsuit. It's been working its way through the courts for a couple of years. We're at the stage now where we're appealing to the United States Supreme Court. The decisions by the judges are just, it's disgusting. You know, these judges, they get paid a lot, they get a lot of prestige, and they're lazy. I mean, we presented a lot of evidence to the district court, federal district court judge, and he wrote a decision that just showed he didn't read what we provided in written briefs and what we provided in oral testimony, you know, at hearing. In fact, he issued his decision the next day, I think it was, very quickly after the oral hearing. He'd already written the damn decision. And so we appealed to the Court of Appeals, and it was clear. In fact, their decision was one fucking sentence. Excuse my language. I mean, they didn't take it seriously. They just said, we agree with the district court. They didn't explain why. So now we're going to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is a long shot, not optimistic, but, you know, we keep fighting. I think our more fruitful way of changing this back to something that's reasonable in terms of ballot access in New York is by legislation. And a couple of weeks ago, a few of us Greens met with the staff of a state senator who has a bill that deals with one aspect of ballot access, which was the number of votes you need to keep your ballot line. The bigger problem is the number of signatures we need, which is now 45,000 in 42 days. It's the hardest petition in the country. Richard Winger of Ballot Access News said, Cornel West may get on every ballot but New York. In fact, New York may be the only state in the country without an independent or third-party candidate on a ballot for president. That's how terrible this law is, thanks to Andrew Cuomo. And I have to say the Democrats, including the so-called progressive and Democratic Socialist Democrats, who have been silent. They've been crickets on this issue. And it's such an anti-democratic thing. You know, they just don't want the competition. So we do have some legislators we're trying to work with to get a bill introduced. And ideally, it would be introduced at the beginning of the next session in January and quickly be adopted so it could go into effect in 2024. More likely, I'm afraid, is that we'll get it introduced and it might get debated and then it would be adopted like in June. And they'll say, the Board of Election can't get ready for 2024 with this new standard, so we'll do it, in 2026. Of course, Cuomo got his change passed in April as an attachment to the budget, and nobody said they don't have enough time. So, you know, we're fighting, and I think we can get some legislators, and then we got to, have a big public campaign and shame these anti-democratic Democrats into supporting this pro-democracy legislation. And there are probably some Republicans that will vote for it, and the Libertarians could help us with that. So, we're working on it. And it's one of those issues, the broader left, the socialist left, is just not on their radar. You know, besides ballot access, there's the question of the exclusionary nature of winner-take-all plurality elections, which creates a dynamic of if the elections are close, voting for the lesser evil. If they're not, you get gerrymandering and one or the other party in that district has control of that district. It's a one-party district. That's true of 90% of the House seats, 95% of state assembly seats around the country, state legislative seats. And so what we got to do is have an inclusive multi-party democracy, which ranked choice voting and particularly proportional representation through ranked choice voting and multi-member districts for legislative bodies would create. That should be at the top of the list, or one of the few at the top of the list for the left in this country. And, I've been talking about this for 2 years. It's been the main thing I've tried to push, whether I'm talking to the socialist, revolutionary socialist groups or the progressive Democrats of America. Everybody kind of nods, yeah, you're right, but they're not doing anything about it. So that's why we need the Green Party. That's an issue that, every level you can raise that issue, municipal elections, state elections, federal elections. And so, ballot access is only part of it. Once we get on the ballot, then we should have an election where every party gets its fair and proportional share of representation in government, instead of what we got now, where the plurality or a small majority gets all the power in that district. They just had elections in Arlington, Virginia. I think it was a Democratic primary. And the members were very divided. Had an issue. I think it had to do with zoning. I forget the issue, but I think it had to do with zoning. And there were, people for more inclusionary zoning and people against it. And it was split pretty much down the middle. And the people, I forget which side, maybe had 55% of the vote on election day. And under winner-take-all plurality elections, it was a race for one seat. Under winner-take-all elections, I think it was for two seats. In any case, under winner-take-all elections, the 55% would have got all the representation. They did proportional ranked choice voting. So it was two seats. And what happened was, because the electorate was divided, one representative from each point of view got elected. And of course, the people with the who wanted to get all the power were upset about that. So they're suspending the use of that for the general election. But the ranked choice voting, proportional ranked choice voting, worked as expected. and everybody got representation. Instead of what will happen with just winner take all plurality in the fall is whoever's got the slight majority is going to get all the power and everybody else will get none. And that you can't call that a democracy. It's exclusionary. Let's put it that way. So I think those are huge issues that the Greens should, you know, we should be the champions of that. It should be one of our signature issues. And it really is, because we're pretty much the only ones talking about it. We just need to give it a higher profile, more emphasis, I believe. Okay, so our hour's up. And as I mentioned, we got a couple guests coming up August 5th, August 12th. I was hoping there's, you know, people mentioned local candidates. There is a couple of local candidates that I was expecting phone calls from this week who just want to talk about their campaigns, but I was going to see if they might be good guests for the podcast. So who knows? We might get that by 29th next week. But on the 5th, as I mentioned, we will have Rafael Bernabe, who is a Puerto Rican senator elected by the Third Party Citizens Victory Movement, talking about the Green New Deal and anti-imperialism as it concerns Ukraine and Puerto Rico. And then we'll be talking the following week, August 12th, with Svetlana Romanko, who was the 350.org representative in Ukraine, climate activist, probably best known around the world for disrupting the last COP conference in Cairo, Egypt, by, you know, telling the Russian delegation where she thought they should go. And now she heads an organization called Razum We Stand, which is fighting for ending dependence on oil and defeating the petrostates politically and advancing a green reconstruction of Ukraine. So that's coming up in early August. And I believe we'll have some more guests the following two weekends. So with that, thanks for being here today. And have a good week. Take care in the heat. It can be deadly. Stay hydrated. Stay cool. And we'll see you next week.